call the Great Salt Advisory Council meeting to order. Welcome to all here. Let's go around the room and just tell us your name and who you're with. We'll start with Laura.
My name's Laura Vernon, and I'm with Forest Fire State Lands.
Waylon Myers, the sewer people.
Chris Montague, for Dave Middlemore.
I'm Dina Blaze in Salt Lake County.
Dan Tuttle, Door County.
I'm Jeff Richards, Migratory Bird Production Areas.
Tom Gordon, Municipalities.
Leonard Rowe, representing Aquaculture and the Bright Industry.
And Jake Van Orn, Division Water Quality.
Oh, I'm sorry. Ellis Sorensen, Auburn.
Marcel Shute, National Audubon Society.
Linda Freitas, Friends of Great Salt Lake.
Jeff Den Blanker, Jacobs.
Anna Hill, the Nature Conservancy.
Brian Ackery, with the National Weather Service.
Lando Massey, on the Davis Sewer.
Ben Holkins, with the Division of Water Quality.
Jamie Warren, Forest Fire State Lands.
Ben, you want to go down?
Yeah.
I'm Danny Clark, Bone Confidence Associate.
David O'Leary, U.S. Geological Survey.
Christine Rosie, U.S. Geological Survey.
Ryan Gordon, Cargill.
Tom Tripp, Bullock County Commissioner, also with U.S. Magnesium, representing somewhat the extraction industries that contribute $1.3 billion.
You got it, Jeff.
Matt, Steve, please use our...
I got one.
Please, my company, you know, I'm part of the...
Jan, describe the people who can help us.
Steve Harrison, you know, Audubon Council, Great Face of Water.
Thank you, everyone, for being here. Wanted to welcome Dina. We'll comment on your membership in a minute. Thank you for being here, your first meeting representing Salt Lake County. And we do have a quorum of members in attendance. You received an agenda in advance of the meeting. We didn't receive any suggested changes or additions, so I'll entertain a motion to approve the agenda.
Move.
I'm second. Jeff, second by Colin. Any debate or discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed nay? Any abstentions? Unanimous. You also received meeting notes of the meeting of January 8, 2020, put together by Jake. Thank you, Jake. We received no corrections or changes to those minutes, so I'll entertain a motion to approve those meeting notes.
So moved.
Thank you, Lena. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, Colin, thank you. Any debate or discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed nay? Any abstentions?
I need to abstain. I wasn't a member.
All right, that's a good reason. One abstention, and the motion passes. Let's move to the 10:05 meeting agenda item, committee reports, council project status and updates. Let's start with the 2019 annual report issued in February 2020. Nature Conservancy has a big role in putting that together, so I've asked that they give us a brief introduction to it.
We're happy to be part of it and contribute a little bit, but the lion's share of the writing of the annual report fell on Don's shoulders as usual, so Don put a lot of work into it, production of it as well. And as far as distribution, Nature Conservancy uses it for meetings and outreach and donors and board members. But I know that we're talking about just further distribution. And so, Laura, I think you and Don maybe have the latest on that.
Yeah, we distributed copies of the annual report to the legislature this year. Representative Fox was our sponsor in the House, and Meekins was our sponsor in the Senate. And so they all received copies, and Don and I will get together after this and team up and figure out how to distribute within DNR to the leadership there. And we're open to any other distribution opportunities that may arise.
All right, any questions, comments? Thank you again to the Nature Conservancy. We did follow the typical format. I know that on the inner left-hand page, it lists our statutory responsibilities and a summary of how we fulfilled those during the year. The end of page 3 summarizes the major projects we've undertaken during the year. Page 4 summarizes the meetings that we've held during the year. Did everyone get one? Next item, council membership update. Leland Myers, chair of our membership committee.
You're up.
I'm up.
Hate to interrupt you, Leland.
Yeah.
Looking for a membership report.
Our membership is full at the moment. We have, Dina has been approved by the Senate, so that's full effect. So we have all the counties represented and all the other positions filled. We have four positions, four or five, I can't remember which. We have several positions that are expires June 1st, 2020. And of course, Dina's is one of those. But we're working with the governor's office to try and have hers and Gage Froer's just continued on because they were both recent appointments. So we won't have to do anything with that. The other ones that are expiring are Todd Bingham's for the extractive industry. We have an application for an individual from that arena that would be nominated by some of the work groups to take his place. We have Dave's position that's expired in the conservation interest. He needs to, in the worst sort of way, get on the internet and fill out his application, update it, and send in a new resume so they can be happy with it. And then Jess is also expiring, and you need to do the same thing. You get on the governor's boards and commission's website. You don't have a password, you'll have to get one, but you're on there, and you just need to update your resume.
I've done that.
And have you?
Yep.
I thought you guys did yesterday.
Will you let me know if it's not on there?
Okay, I'll check.
Because I did that after our last meeting.
Okay, I'll check, but it wasn't as of yesterday or the day before.
Okay.
Did you supply them with a new resume too?
I did.
Okay. I'll check it in.
Okay.
Other than that, we're complete and full. We think we'll stay that way, we're hoping.
Thank you, Lynn. Appreciate your following up on those details. Now let's move to the next item, a brief update on the Salinity Advisory Committee. Jeff, just a minute, if you'd give us an update.
Yeah, the committee's been very busy. They completed a round robin December through this last month to try to evaluate how different organizations are measuring salinity in the lake and compare results. I think we had eight different participants, different organizations who sampled and provided results for that. Right now they're working on developing a standard procedure for measuring salinity, so everybody's using the same methods, reporting similar type of results that can be used to compare data across all the different agencies, organizations. Right now, I guess the next steps for the committee, they're going to be working on trying to define what some thresholds are for salinity that support the various beneficial uses of the lake, and also defining additional research monitoring that should be conducted to be able to better understand the salt transfer from the south and north arm between the two north arms of the lake, and look at how salinity might be managed in the future.
Thank you, Jeff. Any questions?
And I guess we do have a one-day meeting coming up at the first day of the Great Salt Lake Issue Forum on Wednesday, May 6th, where the Salinity members of the Salinity Advisory Committee will be giving short presentations on what we've learned about the salinity of the lake and having some panel discussions to really try to accelerate progress, move that forward. In the context of the issues for me.
Thank you, Jeff. Any questions?
And we'll meet tomorrow. Yes.
Time and place of the meeting tomorrow?
The meeting's at 1 o'clock. It's at the Department of Natural Resources at the research, or core research center, which is way back in the back part of their parking lot. Sorry, Jim.
Thank you. Okay, next, as you know, the Great Salt Lake Technical Team is the technical advisor to the Advisory Council, and so we periodically have reports from them regarding the research they're monitoring and as well as the research they're facilitating. I've asked Laura if she'd give us a brief summary today of the hot topic and grants that are underway.
Yes, I have a summary of Greg Carling's work from BYU. It's just hot off the press, and I only have the executive summary, and it's super technical, and I just got it last night, so I'm going to do my best to summarize his work. And if you have further questions about what I say, please direct them to him on May 12th at our Great Salt Lake Tech Team meeting. He'll be talking about it in more detail then, and we should have the final report. But Carling's work is actually the second year we funded him, and he's building on some work that he did in 2017, I believe. But the title is Understanding the Environmental Impacts of Great Salt Lake Dust Using Isotopic Fingerprints to Determine Dust Sources and Quantifying Changes in Trace Metal Concentrations from Source to Deposition. The purpose of the study is to utilize isotopic fingerprints to quantify the relative contributions of dust to total dust deposition to the Wasatch Front and mountain snowpack, and to identify processes responsible for trace metal enrichment during transport and deposition. He had three objectives in his studies. The first one was to develop additional isotopic fingerprints for distinguishing GSL dust from other dust sources. And it looks like for this, he looked at mostly or deposition along the Wasatch Front, Provo, Salt Lake, Ogden, Logan, and then he also looked at deposition in the Uinta Mountains and the Wasatch. So he talks primarily about strontium isotope and says that the ratios range widely in the Playa dust sources. From severe dry lake and the Great Salt Lake, the strontium ratios and dust deposition in the Wasatch Front urban area in Provo, Salt Lake, Ogden, Logan, and the snowpack Uinta and Wasatch were within the range of Playa values, with lower values in Provo relative to Salt Lake and Ogden. The isotope ratios in the Uinta snowpack were lower than the Wasatch, but both were similar to urban dust. Other isotopes that were measured, uranium, lead, and boron, did not show promise for tracing dust from the playas of the Great Salt Lake or severely to the Wasatch Front and the snowpack, with urban and snowpack values plotting outside the range of values from playas. This suggests that uranium, lead, boron deposition is dominated by local urban sources rather than playa sources. The second objective of this study was to quantify seasonal contributions of Great Salt Lake dust deposition to the Wasatch Front and mountain snowpack. Again, he talked about strontium, and it said it varied over time with each urban site. The highest ratio changed, the site with the highest ratio changed during each sampling period, with Salt Lake and Ogden showing the most variability. So the model he used only quantified Great Salt Lake dust and severe lake dust and excluded other dust sources. He says it should be considered a maximum estimate of dust contributions from the Great Salt Lake. With results of the mixing model, so with the two dust sources, shows seasonal spatial variability in the amount of Great Salt Lake dust that is affecting the Wasatch Front over a two-year period. The fraction of Great Salt Lake dust varied from 0 to 18% in Provo, 16 to 48% in in Salt Lake, 24 to 48% in Ogden, and 12 to 49% in Logan during the study period. On average, Great Salt Lake contributed 5% of the dust to Provo and between 30 to 34% of the dust to Ogden, Salt Lake, and Logan. For snowpack, Great Salt Lake contributed an average of 9% of the dust to the Uintas and an average of 22% of dust to the Wasatch. And finally, his third objective was to evaluate the geochemical changes in the dust from source to sink. Dust chemistry changes that dust deposition to the Wasatch. Dust chemistry indicates that dust deposition from the Wasatch front is a mixture of playa dust and urban anthropogenic aerosols. Most elements were found at similar concentrations within a factor of 2 in the playa and urban snow dust samples. However, several anthropogenic trace elements were enriched in snow and urban dust relative to playa dust. For example, copper concentrations were enriched in snow and urban dust samples, suggesting that local anthropogenic copper source adds to the background of playa dust. Snow samples that were collected from the sites are distal from the urban area and a higher elevation, suggesting that the snow dust is less impacted by the local anthropogenic contamination compared with urban samples. And with this, he was looking at selenium, silver, antimony, and cadmium. And that's all I can say about that. Tom, I asked you not to ask me any questions.
I'm not going to ask any questions. If I'm just making a statement here, the playa of that dust goes from here to Wendover. That playa is a very big area. It's not like it's the close shoreline of the Great Salt Lake that contributes all that. The playa is the Great Salt Lake Desert.
Thank you.
Thank you, Laurel. Would someone please ask a very difficult technical question?
No. I do have one more update on the Hot Topic Tech Team grants for 2021. We have a list of topics in case you're all interested in what people are thinking is a hot topic this day and age. So we have a couple that we're going to put out. This hot topic list will be distributed, or the RFP will be distributed probably at the end of this month, so applicants can get their research lined up before the beginning of the fiscal year. So first topic is Gunnison Bay salt crust. The second topic, Great Salt Lake waterfowl production. I'm going to address that in a while. Number 3 is wetland revegetation and restoring ecosystem services. This has to do in large part with Phragmites, all the Phragmites work that's been done around the lake. Microbial primary production, not bioworms, but microbialites. Quantifying the connection between groundwater input to the Great Salt Lake and active microbialite communities, and groundwater and shoreline surface crust mechanics. We did have some discussion about mass balance in the lake and the deep brine layer, but this is also something that the Salinity Advisory Committee, I think, is working to tackle together. And so one thing we talked about in addressing the deep brine layer and mass balance was to maybe next year look at taking all of the $200,000 that's allocated for Hot Topics Tech Team research grants to put towards some concentrated Salinity Advisory Council recommendations, if that makes sense to the group. So that's what I've got.
Any comments or questions? Appreciate your sharing that with us. The next item on the agenda is just a brief update of the status of council projects. If you look inside the annual report, you'll note that 2019 was a very busy year in terms of informing the debate, which is what we've been about from the beginning, is to try to bring to bear information that can help policymakers and others make the right decisions regarding Great Salt Lake. During 2020, we have another long list of projects we're working on, consistent with the approval of this group. We've entered into, along with another number of other parties, a contract with the USGS on a major nutrient cycling study. There's an RFQ that's outstanding that should close this week, I believe, to provide consulting services to develop a plan to share Great Salt Lake information. We produce these reports, we get them to who we can get them to. We think there's a wider audience out there, and we're requesting help developing a plan to get the information out to the public. We have an RFQ outstanding. As you recall, in 2019 legislative session, HCR 10 was passed, which required the Department of Environmental Quality and the Department of Natural Resources by the end of this year to produce a list of recommendations to address the issue of water supply for the Great Salt Lake. And to help those agencies accomplish that task, they've appointed a steering group, a number of individuals who will help put this list together, and they needed a facilitator, someone to help facilitate that process and put together a final report. We have an RFQ out for that process that I think also the application date is the end of this week. We, in 2017-18, spent a lot of time developing a document that included 72 possible strategies to get water to Great Salt Lake. In 2018, we prioritized those and came up with a list of what we thought were the highest priority items. We have entered into a contract with a group to conduct a feasibility study on those highest priority strategies to determine what it would take to get them implemented. And those strategies, for example, number one and number three were similar. It's shepherding water. If you conserve water upstream, how do you get it to the lake? Split season leases is another one that I recall off the top of my head. So we have a law firm and an engineering firm who have joined together to submit a proposal, and they've been selected, and we expect by July to have a report on this feasibility study for water for Great Salt Lake and how to remove the impediments to increasing water delivery to the lake. We have discussions ongoing regarding the next steps for the GSLIM model, and those haven't landed on exactly what to do. It should involve expanding the time frame of the data in the model. Could be involved adding bidirectional flow data to the model. Could involve a more detailed handoff of the model to the Department of Natural Resources. But our subcommittee is working on how to prioritize those steps. So there's a lot going on this year, and hopefully we'll have some more good information to help inform the debate around the Great Salt Lake. Any questions about that?
Who was the law firm selected for the?
Clyde and Snow, along with Jacob Engineering. Yes, Lynn.
At the Issues Forum, actually, we're going to have a panel discussion on shepherding.
Okay.
How do we, you know, if we get beneficial use status for the open waters of Great Salt Lake, if we get water from various contributors, how do we actually get it to the lake? And so that's a really important part of an important triptych of obstacles. So we'll be talking about that at the forum.
And that was our number one priority among the 72 strategies. Thank you, Lynn. Other comments or questions? All right, let's keep moving on our agenda. The next item, we've invited Brian McInerney of the National Weather Service to come and give us a water supply forecast for 2020. It's been a few years since we've had such a report, and it's, of course, the water supply is important to a lot of the issues we're working on. Brian, thank you for being with us today.
Where we are with the water supply forecast, and then and kind of go over some ideas of where we might be headed. So when you look at 2020 and our water year pattern, right as about February, this is basically the red is what you're looking at, and green, that kind of flowing river look, that's the jet stream. And the jet stream is about 25,000 feet in elevation, roughly, and where the jet stream goes, where the storm track goes. And what you see is kind of this clockwise rotating blue area out over the Pacific. That's high pressure. High pressure indicates you're not going to have much weather. It's kind of calm. We get inversions here. We get poor air quality when we have high pressure. When you have that big red area over the top of you, that's the strongest winds at the upper elevations. And that's where the storms are. That's where the energy is coming. And for a good chunk of February, it was coming from the northwest. Northwest flow is the dominant weather feature. We've been lucky for the past 2 years. We haven't had high pressure parked over the western U.S. The high has been more out over the Pacific, because when we get that high pressure parked over the western U.S., that's when drought sets in. That's when we have low snowpacks, we have really poor air quality, and we don't get much runout. Fortunately for us this year, it's been out over the Pacific. But something to note, this high pressure weather pattern, this dipole they call it, where you have high over the west, low over the Midwest and the east, is becoming more prevalent. We're seeing more and more of this. There were studies out of Stanford University that looked at this, and that doesn't bode well for our water supply in the long term. Not only that, we have the warming of the atmosphere. So those two things we have working against us. These past 2 years have been fortunate. We haven't seen high pressure for the most part. We had a lot of northwest flow. It really benefits Big and Little Cottonwood. They were the big winners of this weather pattern. And then what happened was, in the past, roughly about a month, the jet stream is shifted north to us. So the main energy has been north of us. It's gone up into the Pacific Northwest, and we've had that bit of high pressure right over us. And if you kind of see how it wiggles like that, that's why we have had warmer temperatures, lack of really big storms, and that's tough to see in March, because what's happening is, over time, as we're warming, we've warmed in Utah 2 to 3 degrees, we're warming much faster than the global average, we have earlier snow melts during spring snow melt runoff processes. And what that means is anytime you melt earlier, you get a less efficient runoff. Your runoff efficiency, you get a lot more evaporation, transpiration, the plants come back early, you have less water coming into the Great Salt Lake and really throughout areas that need it. And we're seeing that today. However, when you look at the latest run we have, and this is actually a rendition of the winds at that 25,000 feet. This is the GFS model we're looking at. Notice that little spinning counterclockwise out by Southern California. That's what's called a cutoff low. These things kind of take on a mind of their own. They're little spinning counterclockwise weather features, but they do bring a lot of moisture. They do bring some much needed moisture for Southern Utah, which really got shut out as of January 1st. Their water supply basically came from two events, two atmospheric river events, these long, narrow, they used to call them the Pineapple Express. They had two of those early on, and they had 200% snowpack right around Christmas time. And since then, the pattern has shifted to that of northwest flow. They haven't seen any precipitation at all. And this is a nice reprieve for them. We're going to see another one of these cutoff lows next week that hopefully will bring us more precipitation up here. They're a little harder to forecast because they cut off, they're kind of their own little system. They're cut off from the major flow. So they kind of drift around a little bit. The key is we want to stay cold. We want to see more storms coming westerly, northwest, southwest, it really doesn't matter. You don't want high pressure parked over us. That's the big deal. That's the big problem. And we don't see that as of right now. So when you look at precip, this is the total precip anomaly. What I'll do is start at the water year in October. And warm colors indicate drier conditions. And when you see that red, that's basically zero precip. during the month of October over a lot of the southwestern desert. So when we started the water year, we always kind of worried that high pressure is going to set up over the west, and that'll be the dominant weather feature, this dipole weather pattern that we're starting to see more and more. That's always a worry. So October got here. When you look at Utah, we had hardly any precipitation to start the water year. Then what happened is the pattern shifted, and you see that kind of purple green color coming up from southern Utah, Washington counties, and then up into the Uintas. That's a direct result of two atmospheric river events. They're incredibly potent. They're about 300 miles wide. They're about 2 miles deep. And then it's super saturated air that comes from around Hawaii. And it's like a river that moves up. There's like phenomenal statistics on this, how many Mississippi rivers there are with each atmospheric river event. And if you can get a couple of these, you can set up pretty well, as southern Utah did. So we saw that in November. And then really, the rest of the Wasatch, the northern Wasatch, didn't benefit as much, but we were starting to see upstream a lot more energy. We didn't see that high pressure building. And then into December, we did really well all throughout the entire state. We had a combination of northwest flow, we had additional southwest flow, we did really well. The skiing picked up, the snow in the mountains got above average, and our weather pattern looked really progressive. We were a nice benefit. And then what happened is that the southwest flow, that turned off. We got more northwest flow. And that benefits the northern mountains tremendously. But when you look at, an example of this, 2019, St. George had the wettest calendar year on record. You know, the wettest, going back to the late 1800s. Yet, within that period, they had 155 days without any measurable precip whatsoever. So when you get precip now with our warming climate, what you find is it's much more intense. But we used to get a guy with a hose that was spraying in a mist that would come by frequently. Now what we've done is tighten it up and you get the blast, but if you don't get it, you get nothing. Everything is much more extreme. So there's a lot more variability in the precip that we're getting in Utah, really throughout the western U.S. and the world for that matter, but we're seeing it. So the pattern shifted in January, northwest flow, we were still doing quite well. And then what you see is that jet stream that traveled north of Utah. And you can see up in Wyoming, parts of Montana, northern Idaho, and Oregon, they did much better because that jet stream was coming over the top. We were under high pressure, so we had a lot of that brown colorization, which is roughly 50 to 70% average precip during that time. Also, when you look at this, we've had periods, not much, but it's been a little warmer, but then we had about 3 days where it was about 15 degrees above average. And what we've done is taken the snowpack that's in the mountains and made it much more dense. And that's a problem, because what you don't want is a really dense snowpack in about March. You want it to be roughly about 30% density, but when it gets to be about 50% density, that's when it starts yielding meltwater. And you can melt prematurely because there's processes that go into the snowpack, the solar radiation, that you need to get it isothermal before it will release any meltwater. You want that process to take time so you can get into May, so the sun's energy is at the highest angle, it gets quite warm, and you can get a really good melt process. We've got an overly dense snowpack right now, which might indicate that we're going to melt early, which means it will be inefficient. Hopefully that's not the case. Hopefully we'll get a pattern shift. And then when you look at March 1st through the 5th, this is what you see. A lot of the country, there was not much precip at all. And so we had November, December, which were really good months. January was that transitional period. Now we're into February, March, and it doesn't look very good. We have these two cutoff lows that are coming. It'll add some moisture, but not what we need. We need just good storms coming across. So we might be a little low. When you look at October through February, and you look at where it really counts, this is the precip amounts for the mountain areas. And what you find is we're roughly in that kind of that brown area, 70 to 90% precipitation with some 90 to 100%. And if you look down in southern Utah, they're in the green. They're 100 to 110. Again, that was two events. They haven't had any precedent really since about the end of Christmas time. They're going to get some now, but you look at this and it's kind of deceiving how, depending how you look at the data. When you look at temperatures, what you find is December through February, it really hasn't been that warm compared to the 30-year average from 1981 to 2010. And that's a good thing. If you look at the eastern part of the country, they've been really quite warm with about 3 to 5 degrees above average. You want to stay as cold as possible for as long as possible. We're doing that somewhat, but we're starting to slide into those really warm days where everything is melting. And then when you look at the first 9 days of March, again, not too warm, and it's been okay. So the fact that we have this very dense snowpack is kind of mystifying, because when you go back, if you're a skier, the skiing was really good, you know, early on. It was in the light powder snow, it was cold. We only had this very dense snow kind of moisture laden when we had that big avalanche cycle in January, I think it was, when it started. And so I'm not really sure why we have so much. So let's take a look at snowpack, at least as far as what's going on with influence in the Great Salt Lake. So these graphics, what I did was I took all the snowtail stations run by the NRCS in each basin, averaged them together, compared it to average 2019, which is last year in the green, 2020, which is where we are right now. And you can see for the Bear River drainage, we're at 102% of median. And this was a couple of days ago when I did this. But you can see it's been right, you know, pretty close to average, pretty close to median. Sometimes people have a hard time understanding what median is, but if you just kind of figure it's normal. But you can see last year, about this time, the pattern really benefited us, and it really picked up. And it went all the way, and it went late three weeks, and we had a really great run out. And we're still seeing the benefits of this. We're not seeing that right now. Things have tapered off really in the last 2 weeks due to that pattern shift. If you look at the Weaver, they're only at 94%. You can see a much more dramatic straight line going across really as of, you know, maybe the mid-February timeframe. Whereas last year, things picked up and the skiing got really good and the snow picked up and we were doing much better than we were last year. So 94% of the Weaver, Six Creeks, this is basically Little Cottonwood all the way up to City Creek. They were the direct benefit of that northwest flow, because when you think of storms coming out of the northwest, it picks some roughly about 10%, probably less because the Great Salt Lake is so low, maybe 5% additional water content. And then you need lift to make it snow. And the Wasatch Mountains have this perfect lifting mechanism that it goes right up the Cottonwood. And it snows 8% density, and it's great snow, it's world class. And we saw that because the storms coming out of the northwest favor that area. Southwest favors Provo Canyon, that little ramp going up Provo Canyon. So when you think of Deer Valley, Sundance, they do quite well in southwest flow. The southern aspect of the Uintas do well. Northwest flow favors Big and Little Cottonwood. Now they're at 117%, but you can see it's kind of tapered off as of early February. And then down in Provo, you know, we talked about this area is much more favorable with southwest flow. This northwest flow didn't help them at all. You can see last year when the storms were coming up from the southwest, the Provo did wonderful last year. They did great. This year, not so much. We're at 87%. And understand, we're still in the ballpark here. Things are okay. They're not great. But we've had some years. 2018 was the driest year on record. We just blew past that 2 years ago. Unfortunately for us, between a warming climate, we're transitioning from a total snow-driven hydrology in December, January, February, to that of a rain-driven hydrology. Our winters are starting later, they're melting out earlier, we're getting rain in the later years, and that is only going to creep together until eventually it's not going to snow in Wasatch or in any of the mountains. Until about, when you look at 2035 to 2065, areas that are snow-covered, 100% snow-covered in December, January, February, will probably snow-covered 50% to 25%. By about 2080, we're really not going to see snow in Wasatch anymore. There'll be snow at Big and Little Cottonwood at the very tops. Maybe the Uintas will have snow at the very tops, but about 2100, it'll be a rain-driven hydrology throughout the West. How do we get water supply? That's a whole different topic that we don't have time for now, but that's in our future. Plus, with the increasing weather patterns of that dipole weather pattern, high pressure in the west, low pressure in the middle part of our country in the east, we're not going to see as much storminess as we used to, and we're seeing that right now. When you look at, how we do average is a 30-year block, and if the meteorological standard jumps every 10 years. We're going to jump here from 1981 to 2010 to 1991 to 2020. We're putting the data together right now. When you go back and look at the average from 1961 to 1990, and you compare it to the average we're in now, we have a significant decline in the amount of stream flow that we have, all the way down to the Colorado at about 14%. So we're in it right now. We just need to plan for it because we're too far down the road to stop this right now. The only thing we can do is kind of see how we're going to adapt and be a little more resilient, but that's a tall order we have. So when you look at the snowpack, and this was about a week ago, maybe 5 days ago I put this together. This is where we are by basin. It kind of gives you an idea. And it's okay. It'll work. You know, we have really good reservoir contents right now. So when you look short term, we're doing okay. We're going to have pretty good water for the farmers, and that's great. Municipalities won't have any problems. It's just the long term. When you look long term, it's really quite depressing, especially for this job that I've got. And I go around and talk about the science, and people just look shocked. They look like, oh my God, why did we invite this guy? So let's do this. We'll look at two or three points for each drainage, and we'll start with the barrel. Just to give you an indication of what we have for our forecast what's going to happen. And the barrel provides the majority of the water into the Great Salt Lake. So we'll look at 2 points, Woodruff Narrows Reservoir and then Stewart Dam. And what this is a forecast made by the Colorado Basin River Forecast Center, which is in the same room as my office at the Weather Service. And on the y-axis, that's volume in thousands of acre feet that's expected to come by this point from April 1st through the end of July. And it's a metric. That solid line is average, the dotted green line below that is median, the dotted line way up high is the highest it's ever been at this point, the dotted line on the bottom is the driest it's ever been. And then with the forecasts that we make, we do a range of possibilities, because we only can forecast weather 7 days out, 5 days really. Beyond that, the whole process falls apart. So if you ever get a 10-day forecast or beyond, it's kind of a goof. It's about five to 7 days. So as a result, there's a lot of unknown when we make the forecast in January. So we're going to say what's going to happen in the spring. We really don't know what the weather's going to do. But what we do is say, what do we have right now? We have snowpack on the ground, and we have soil moisture. We can measure those two things. And then we take 30 years of climate data from temperature and precip and plug it into the model and say, 30 years ago on this year, we had this much rain and this much temperature, and then plug it into the hydro model, and you get a line, and then you get another line for the next year. You get kind of a spaghetti plot, and that's what that blue area shows. So you can see the forecast in that thin little blue line that kind of snakes through there. That's the actual model. But the forecast that we make, that the hydrologist looked at it, and put a stamp on there, that's where those vertical lines come from. So a lot of talk, but what this is saying is the headwaters of the Bear Woodruff Narrows Reservoir is at 83% average this year, expected from April through the end of July. If you look at median, it's 91%. But you can see it's kind of oscillated back and forth. When you go to Stewart Dam, this is right by Bear Lake, about the same, 97% average, 150% median. So somewhere in that okay range. And when you go down to the Weaver, we'll look at Oakley at that point, and then East Canyon Reservoir, and then Pine View Reservoir. And we'll start with Oakley. This is the headwater point up in the mountains, up high. 82% average, 84% median is what we're anticipating coming out. And that's roughly 97,000 acre feet of water that's going to move past Oakley in the headwater areas. If you look at East Canyon, 96% or 100% median. And then Ogden Reservoir, Pine View, 89% and 103% median. So in the ballpark, doing okay. Reservoir storage is okay. The problem with the Great Salt Lake is just it gets so much pulled out from the headwaters. If you look at the hydrology of, and you guys know this, you can have a pretty good headwater forecast, and then you take it down the river, and after everything is over allocated, hardly any makes it to the Great Salt Lake, and that means your Great Salt Lake is drying up due to two factors: the over allocation of water upstream, and then the overall climate change that we're seeing right now. Terminal lakes, and I looked at your pamphlet, which is really well done, by the way, indicated the terminal lakes are drying up with warming climate. I saw a researcher probably about 10 years ago come to the U who had the very same topic, saying that when you look at terminal lakes in a warming climate, they tend to get smaller until they shrink up and dry up. And we're seeing this right now. And this is just going to continue. This isn't going to turn around. This is something we should expect. Little Cottonwood, City Creek, we'll start with Little Cottonwood. 97% of average, 106% median. This number is a little higher because of that northwest flow, and Big Cottonwood really benefited from what we've got going here. And then City Creek is 84% average, 110% median. So overall, when you look at the headwater areas and everything that contributes to the Great Salt Lake, really not too bad up to this point. And then we'll take a look at Utah Lake, and we'll look at Provener Woodland, and then Spanish Fork River near Castilla. And the Provener River near Woodland is a high elevation watershed at 91% average, 90% median. Even though it's in the Provo, they didn't do as well. When you look at the Spanish Fork River Basin, you know, when you're driving from Provo to Price, that watershed right there, the Spanish Fork watershed, is a low elevation watershed. Every year these numbers are coming in lower and lower because they're getting rain at low elevations, not so much snow at the high elevations. So when you look at water supply, what you expect in the spring, this basin, the Spanish Fork River, is always lower because it has that lower elevation watershed. So here's what it looks like on the runoff volume forecast. As is early March, these numbers have probably declined a little bit due to our lack of snow. And we are on the 11th, so we're a third of the way through March. My feeling is these numbers are going to decline a little more, depending on what kind of weather we get for the next 2 weeks. If we can kind of shift the pattern and bring that jet stream back down to us on a good trajectory, bring cold air from up north, these numbers will increase, but it doesn't look like it right now. When you look at drought, this is the drought designator. They call it the U.S. Drought Monitor, and this product was started some years back because everybody would do their own analysis of drought, and they thought, let's put a comprehensive idea and look at it in a big comprehensive way. And the Weather Service Office, we contribute to this based on what we've just talked about. We say this is what we see for Utah. And so this was December 31st. If you can see some of those darker areas, moderate drought is D1. It's kind of that darker brown, and the lighter brown is moderate drought. Yellow is abnormally dry. And really, at the end of 2019, at the end of the runoff season, we were totally out of drought. In 2018, we had some of the highest drought designations in the entire country down in the Four Corners there. But this is December 31st. Here's February 4th. It just kind of shifts a little bit. It doesn't go away. It doesn't get really much bigger. It kind of morphs a little bit. And then here's March 3rd. So up by the Great Salt Lake, they don't consider us a drought. We seem to be doing okay with reservoir contents. One thing to consider is with the hot summer we just had, our soil moisture below this snowpack is really quite dry. We're going to lose a lot of the snow water coolant into the soils before we start seeing runoff this year, and that's a little unfortunate. We didn't have much monsoonal flow, if any, last summer, and that was a direct result of our jet stream. We had so much flow coming through, the moisture from the Pacific didn't make its way up, so we were pretty dry last summer. And if you need anything else, anything on this topic, one thing to note, I'm retiring next month. Okay. But I'll be around till the 30th if I can provide you. I know, right? This job's super fun, but it's 30 years I've been doing this job. I used to be the youngest guy in the office. Now I'm one of those older guys you see kind of toddling around stuff. So give me a call. That's my cell phone. If I can add anything, if you need any more data, they'll be replacing me with someone else, younger, more vigorous, and he'll come and do whatever you need for him, I would hope. There's my email, so give me a call. Can I answer any questions for now?
Questions? Comments? Can I call?
Yep.
Brian, you mentioned with the, you know, the climate change and expect less water and the Great Salt Lake to dry out. Do you have any, Brian, or the king for a day to decide what would save the lake for 100 years from now, what would you do?
I think the first thing, if I were the king, and everybody would listen to me and not yell at me, is I would stop the allocations in the Bear River drainage to the point where they don't take as much. I would change that so you get more inflow on a natural basis. I think if you did that, you would be much better off. I think as far as climate change goes, that's a tough nut because we're too far down the road to do much about it now. I think what we're doing now, all the work that's being done, is trying to figure out where this precipitation area, you know, this line of drier to the south, wetter to the north, they're trying to figure that out. But if I were the king, or if I was the omnipotent entity, I'd go to clean energy. We have to stop taking carbon out of the ground and putting it in the atmosphere. We're just warming the atmosphere due to the physics of those gases re-radiate heat back in. And then we need to take it out of the atmosphere, put it back in the ground. Then we might have a fighting chance for a while. But understand that CO2 stays in the atmosphere for 1,000 years. It doesn't precipitate out, it doesn't change. What we're doing now is affecting our children and our grandchildren in a massive way. I would do those two things. But in reality, I would stop allowing the farmers to take so much water. I would change the water rights and how things go to allow more water to come down into the Great Salt Lake. Because there's people that see the Great Salt Lake as just this terminal nothing. Right? And it's not. How beautiful is this? And it's part of an ecosystem that needs to be kept. And then you have extraction technologies and minerals that are used to help the economy. This is a viable place. And yet, it seems to me that the water rights are kind of antiquated for that purpose and needs to be changed. However, when I've said this with some of the agriculture people, they get out pretty quick. They don't like to hear that. It's whose water, right? I think that's what it comes down to. But if you're gonna keep the way things are, this is gonna dry up. You won't have a Great Salt Lake anymore. It's just gonna be a pan of alkaline dust. And that's unfortunate. Yes?
Just because you're retiring from NOAA, that doesn't preclude your opportunity for further engagement to help with those kinds of things.
Sure. Yeah, I've been doing this for so long. I have a daughter who's 26, Sarah, she's gonna have kids someday, and what I don't wanna do, there's part of me that's like, woo, retirement, you know, let's get on my bike and let's go skiing, but there's another part of me that's like, I can't just give up. You know, I have this information that most of the population either doesn't believe it or they don't understand it. So I started a nonprofit called the Utah Climate Project, and I'm looking for funding right now to do just that. Whether we get funding or not, it's kind of tight in the federal system, but I don't know. And it's with two professors from the University of Utah. So we're kind of in that phase right now. I'd like to do more, but we'll see. And, you know, who knows? I'm bored, maybe looking out the window eating Cheerios and watching Gilligan Island where he runs in. 2 o'clock in the afternoon, give me a call, I can come and help you out. So.
Other questions or comments?
Yeah. Yes.
Just really quick, so the snowpack will be less, but the precipitation overall won't be less, right?
The feeling right now, the line is right about here. North of us is expected to get wetter. South of us is expected to get drier. We have to understand that with a warming atmosphere, you're going to have more evaporation, more evapotranspiration. The plants are not going to be dormant during the winter. They're going to be pulling water out of their roots and transpiring into the atmosphere. We're going to have just more evaporation. And the precipitation is right now more intense but less frequent. So you're going to get long periods of high pressure followed by deluges of rain, very intense rainfall it's either going to be infiltrated into the soil and then transpired out, or it'll fall in a place that there's no reservoirs below it. So they feel it's going to be an overall loss of water, even in this area, probably up in Canada and BC and the border, they're going to probably be wetter overall. Soil moisture is going to be good. It'll be colder than we are here, but overall, the water budget will be better. Here, it's still going to be a loss, even though we're getting more water from the sky. That's the science as it is right now. That's changing, though. They're trying to figure out where this dry line is, and when you talk to the scientists, that's what they're working on. Yeah?
So, you said earlier in your presentation something about the lake level and how much water the cottonwoods get. And so, is the size of the lake the direct relationship to the lake effect in cottonwoods?
No, it's backwards. The size of the lake determines what additional water content will go into the cottonwoods. So when you had a full lake in 1983, the air mass that comes across there has a certain amount of moisture in it. When it goes over the Great Salt Lake, there's evaporation going on because it's warmer than the surrounding frozen ground. And then that goes up into the air mass, transports it, rises on the Wasatch, and then deposits that. And it's about a 10% increase with a full lake on average when you get northwest flow in the right conditions. Now that the lake is much, much smaller, the air mass that goes across there is hitting mostly dust and dirt and not so much water. So there's less water being absorbed absorbed from the evaporation up into the mountains. My feeling is the hard science that I saw was 10% by the University of Utah. At meteorologists, now that the lake is much smaller, I think we're about 5% when the conditions are correct. And that's getting smaller all the time, so eventually we just won't have that effect anymore. But it's the other way around. What you need is more inflow from the Bear and the Weaver systems, is what you need.
So, more questions, comments?
Thanks for the invite.
Brian, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Congratulations on your recovery. The next item on the agenda is a brief legislative update. We typically, after the session is concluded, we typically have a representative come and talk to us about legislation impacting the Great Salt Lake. Since the session doesn't finish for a few more days, I thought we'd just take a few minutes and provide some updates on any legislation impacting the Great Salt Lake. I think I'd like to start by calling Steve Erickson to tell us about it. You may recall about 5 or 6 years ago, the Advisory Council adopted a position paper in support of a full-time staff person, a Great Salt Lake coordinator within the Department of Natural Resources, help staff not only us but the management plan and other Great Salt Lake activities. Steve's kind of been at the forefront of trying to keep that alive.
Yes, and pleased to announce that we got that funding. It's in House Bill 2, and so we'll be hired. Forestry Fire State Lands will be hired along with the council. So that is going to be hopefully a game changer for everything. So we're really pleased about that. Boy, we've had, now that Brian's mentioned the climate change and depletions and diversions, there's nothing happening on the Hill with climate change. It's been denied. The depletions and diversions were not mentioned in state policy, state water policy, and House Bill 41, which is most unfortunate. We do get a mention of Great Salt Lake and the concern about lower levels, but no acknowledgement of either climate change or the depletions and diversions upstream from the lake that are causing a large portion of the reason why the lake's low. We have had a couple of wins. We stopped a bill that would have changed the way that needs assessments are done for hazardous and/or solid waste landfills. Pertains directly to the Promontory Point landfill that is it's now been constructed, and they soon hope to be putting at least box elder municipal waste into that pit. Jeff, you guys got a win for with the landowner liability bill for the duck clubs and for bird sanctuaries. So it's real helpful that that has almost passed. It's gonna be done here this afternoon, probably.
Is it on the calendar? I said this morning.
Well, you know, it's changing all the time. So right now they're wiping the board clean, and the House is dumping their bills into the Senate calendar. And so it's a moving target, but you know, there's no opposition to it. It should be fine. It's just a matter of getting it on the calendar and taking care of it.
So what this bill does is the current law provides limitation of landowner liability. If you open your land to the public free of charge, then you have a heightened liability protection. The reason we ran this bill is primarily for duck clubs. I think it applies to the Audubon property and TNC as well. Is we want to encourage people to come out and enjoy what we have and bring guests. But it's not necessarily open to the general public. So what this bill does is it will allow us to bring guests on our property as long as it's free of charge. It provides an incentive for us to do that and bring people out, share what we have, but not suffer, you know, potential litigation if somebody gets hurt.
Just the bill number.
Bill number?
Well, it's House Bill 296. Senator Christensen is running it in the Senate, and if you want to reach out to your legislator and get that up on the calendar today, that would be great.
A number of good water bills have been passed this year. I mean, Marcel has been in the middle of some of them for water banking and split season leasing. Those are going to all run through on the water banking season leasing. I think it's ready to go sometime in the next day and a half. Also, water optimization moving forward. Water loss mitigation is going to go to a study, unfortunately, not as sophisticated a process as we hoped. But overall, a good year for water legislation, a lot of cleanup stuff. So, as usual, mixed bag with the legislature. I think we've got an uphill battle getting them to understand that we're in some climate change, and acknowledging that's going to be critical at some point. So, thanks.
Let me know just a little bit of this. We're not all of those bills impact Great Salt Lake, but as an advisory council, we are fairly selective in what we formally endorse, and the staffing issue was our position. Anyone else like to share a report or update on legislation impacting Great Salt Lake? I will note that there was a Bill H, House Resolution, or House Bill 10, I think it is, dealing with boards and commissions. A lot of boards and commissions sunset at a point in time, and the legislature has been moving towards doing that with more of them. The bill originally was going to have the Great Salt Lake Advisory Council sunset in 2023. We were able to extend that date to the latest date in the bill to 2027. And we're given an assurance we shouldn't be alarmed about a sunset provision. It's just a trigger for us to go back and justify our existence and be renewed. So, any other comments or reports? Okay, let's go to the next agenda item. Public comments. We always provide an opportunity at our meetings for the public to provide any comment. By the raise of hand, how many here would like to make a comment? Steve, Lynn?
Okay. Real quickly, Great Basin Water Network, its partners at White Pine County, Nevada, had another big win in court over the Las Vegas pipeline. The groundwater development project was really roundly rejected by Judge Robert Estes at the district court level. This is 5-5 now in our legal cases, 4 of which have been in the Nevada courts, and 1 at the federal level with NEPA. So currently, the Southern Nevada Water Authority has no water rights in a pipeline, and they have no right of way for that pipeline. So it's dead in the water as far as we can see. But there's only, they're going to have to do some kind of a legal change to get rid of prior appropriation and groundwater mining prohibitions in their state code, much very similar to ours. Why this is important to Great Salt Lake? It's a little tangential, but the groundwater flow system through Spring Valley to Snake Valley north into Great Salt Lake, aquifer beneath the Great Salt Lake, provides some amount of recharge. It's about 10,000 acre feet estimated by the USGS. Some have estimated a little higher than that, but it keeps the hydrostatic pressure from having saltwater intrusion into valleys to the south, like Snake Valley. So important in the grand scheme long term. Not something we do, that we would see an impact on late in the short term. It's good news.
Thank you. Lynn, do you want to comment?
Yeah, I think most of you know the genesis of this body, Great Salt Lake Advisory Council, was the inspiration of Governor John Huntsman back in 2008. And at that time, the council was charged with the responsibility of taking a look at the way the lake was managed and make recommendations to Governor Huntsman. And at that time, we came up with recommendations, and one of them was a commission to oversee Great Salt Lake, this and that. Governor Huntsman went on to be the ambassador to China in the Obama administration. And in 2010, during the legislative session, the outcome was Governor Herbert basically kept the Great Salt Lake Advisory Council intact. And here we are today, 10 years later. So I'm trying to, without much success at the moment, but I'm trying to invite Governor Huntsman to come and speak at the banquet during the Issues Forum. All of 25 minutes, Governor, that's all really, just 25 minutes. But that's my hope. So I've had some leads. If any of you know Governor Huntsman personally, would you please let me know?
And you let me know the date and I can get him to be there.
Huh?
I can get him to be there, let me know the dates.
Pinky promise.
Pinky
okay.
Promise.
All right. Okay, I'll be in touch. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lynn and Randy.
And I just have a few bird festival pamphlets. If you're interested, the registration opens next week.
And the date of the festival?
Pardon?
The date of the festival.
Oh, it is May 14th to the 17th. Here.
Thank you, Ann. Any other public comments? Then I'll close the public comment period. Next item on the agenda. Remember discussions, deliberations, recommendations, or actions. I would ask if there are any suggestions for presentations, speakers, or topics for future meetings. I'd appreciate any suggestions you might have.
What day is the next meeting?
The next meeting will be on Wednesday, May 13th.
Same week as Bird Festival.
Yeah, Bird Festival. Same week.
Question. Maybe not to think on the agenda, but relative to the study, the legal team and engineering, when can we expect some engagement or information?
Well, the report is due the end of June.
Okay.
Thursday. Okay. So they're up their eyeballs already.
And we've got a July 8th meeting.
We have a July 8th meeting.
Great. Okay.
They'll be here on July 8th to give a report of their work. Any other comments or questions or suggestions for the meeting? One of the items on the agenda for the meeting will be a discussion of how we want to allocate our appropriation for the coming year. So if you give some thought to what you think might be good projects, studies to help inform the debate.
I've talked a few folks with interest in the lake, and from my vantage, this group and the stakeholders here and others have put together some excellent bodies of work that help describe what the needs of the system are, what the benefits of the Great Salt Lake system are, what are the things that impact that. One of the significant things in my view that seems to be a hurdle is the larger community's understanding, appreciation, and stewardship of the lake, understanding that it's going to impact them. It's not just a bunch of people, you know, three of us sitting in a room off the edge of the Great Salt Lake worrying about it, that it's going to impact everyone. So a question to this group, and I'm not asking for an answer, but maybe as I've seen this group and others tackle particular items, is when you have a campaign on a particular issue, you have a campaign strategy and it becomes a project, a program. What I'll pose to this group and maybe others is how do we get that level of understanding and appreciation so that the body politic and the body public understand and can support some actions that are at least informed in the decisions that are impacting the lake. It just seems to me that beyond those that have an active interest in the lake or an active interest in the water that goes to the lake, nobody else, excuse me, gives a shit or understands. And it's education. So I'll throw that out, and I don't know if and how that turns into a project for this group or others. You know, maybe after the election, and you know, if it's Huntsman, and you know, he can re-engage on this issue, we might have a little more collaboration at the government level and support of those that are already in the government that are supporting this. But to me, I see that's being a big piece that will help us avoid going towards a public trust kind of battle over the lake. It's just better if we get friends fighting for the lake. So,
thank you, Sean. Other comments? Dan?
Well, I think we need to invite legislature to come to some of our meetings, and especially if we hold it out to the Great Salt Lake at the Antelope Island and let them see the views from both sides, the west side and the east side, because the east side is where the water is. And I think the only way we're going to kind of win this battle is having more participation in the legislature, firsthand issues, instead of just looking at pictures. And I still have a video of you trying to give a speech out on Antelope Island when we had that hailstorm. I should probably send that to the members here, because some of you didn't see that, but you were out there screaming while the wind was, and it was so awesome. You done a good job.
Dramatic effect.
I thought that was permanently in the archive.
It should be.
Any other comments, questions, suggestions?
I have a question about the annual report. Is that, do we provide that as a desk drop to the legislators?
We do.
I don't know when it was actually printed, but I don't know if that's a possibility or if we have other briefings that could be, obviously it's too late now for that, but maybe during the interim, I don't know what the interim opportunities are for presentations as well.
So it was printed in the latter part of February, and it has been delivered to the legislature and to drop to each legislator.
As a desk drop or in their mailbox?
I asked it to be a desk drop.
Okay.
On the floor.
Yes.
Hopefully it went that way.
I'll double check. I'm sure it is. Okay. Okay, well, hearing no further comments.
Oh, Don, sorry. I just did want to throw out one more possible presentation if the group is interested. Bonnie Baxter and Jamie Butler are wrapping up a new book on all things Great Salt Lake. Wally Gwynn did one, I don't know, 20 years ago. But this is a new, innovative, or it's got a ton of new research all on Great Salt Lake, and that will be published in May. And so maybe they can come and just give a really broad overview of the book. The council's interested in hearing some of the topics that are in the book.
Members of the council interested in that?
Sounds good.
Okay. All right, I'll note on the agenda there are that we meet the second Wednesday every other month, so our next meeting is May 13. Just for council members, do you prefer to meet here or do you prefer to meet over at the administrative offices? Here?
Here. Yeah, I'm the county guy going.
Here. Okay, we'll come back. back here then. Meetings for the balance of the year, July 8th, September 9th, and November 11th. I'll entertain a motion to adjourn the meeting.
Will we adjourn?
And thank you. Is there a second? Thank you, Leland. Any debate or discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Where's the sign-up sheet, attendance sheet? Make sure if you haven't signed that, you give your name on that before you leave.